And we have a great presentation this afternoon, and then we're going to have some Q&A afterwards, so get your questions ready for Miss Nancy. Let's welcome Nancy with Women of the Big Book, Part 2.
Thank you.
We'll see you in a little bit.
Okay, I'm page 89. Got to find out where I was. Hi, my name is Nancy Carvenan. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 24th, 1972. And welcome back to everybody who was here this morning, and welcome to those who weren't here this morning or are now here now. I appreciate that. So this is one. I was asked to pick out two of my favorite readings, it's from page 89, Working with Others in the Big Book. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Thank you. Okay. So we are going to start with a little history on women alcoholics prior to the Big Book. The concept of men helping men and women helping women evolved as a means of AA self-preservation prior to experience proving it wise for the newcomer's sake. There were few women members, so Dr. Bob's wife, Anne, and the other wives worked with female alcoholics. In the fall of 1935, a man we'll call Victor, a former mayor, and a lady we'll call Lil, spent a most sizzling evening in Dr. Bob's office. Lil was the first woman to seek help. However, she and Victor began writing the 13th step long before the 12 were even thought of. Apparently, it began in Dr. Bob's office on his examination table. While he was at the City Club for his revered Monday night bridge game, when Victor decided it was time for him to go on home, the loaded Lil wanted to continue partying. Can you imagine? And Victor called Ernie Galbraith, Dr. Bob's son-in-law, to explain the situation. Ernie's story in the first edition was 7 months slip. When Ernie arrived, he saw Lil going through Dr. Bob's cabinets and grabbing hands full of pills. And we started going around the examination table, and she was trying to stuff the pills in her mouth, Ernie recalled. Then she made a dive for the window, and Ernie caught her halfway out. And she was strong as a horse and used some profanity he had never heard before or since. Ernie quieted her down, and Doc arrived. They took her home to the Smiths and put her in a room in the basement where she sobered up for a while and stayed 2 or 3 days. And that was from Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, page 97 to 98. Love going through this again and again and again, reading these stories. Dr. Bob's daughter, Sue Windows, said that Lil straightened out after a few years and got married, had children. However, she did not find sobriety in AA. Jane Sturtevant, you asked about her earlier, of Cleveland, was the wife of a vice president of a large steel company. Old-timers remembered her story of being left alone to supervise the wallpapering of a room. She and the wallpaper hanger started drinking and kept running around getting tangled up in the rolls of wet paper. Later, her husband found them both passed out, wrapped up in shredded paper and paste, surrounded by empty bottles. She got sober in 1937 in Akron and stayed sober for 12 months. Apparently, she drank again because her story was not included in the first edition of the Big Book. So that answers that question. Others came from the opposite end of the social strata. There's a brief mention of an Indian waitress and an early a woman member who sought help but was thrown out by the wives. She was so bad they wouldn't allow her in their homes. Florence Rankin came to AA in New York in 1937 and after several slips stayed sober over a year. Hers was the only story from a lady alcoholic in the first edition. There's another lady mentioned, but she's the wife of an alcoholic. Florence was the only lady. In 1939, Mary Campbell, a former patient, called on Marty Mann when she was still a patient in Blythewood Sanitarium. If she had not slipped in 1944, Mary would have been the longest sober woman in AA. She remained sober afterward until her death in the 1990s. By that time, Sylvia had come in, and so had Marty. Today, 38% of AA members are women. We've come a long way, baby. I've chosen six stories from the first and second editions because they were our women pioneers. And this lady went on to play an important part in our service structure. Helen Brown, promoted to chronic, from New York, page 485 in the second edition, 464 in the third edition. Helen entered AA in New York in November of 1944, but had a slip in 1945. She started drinking socially and at parties and proms when she was about 20 years old. It made her feel quite grown up and mature. And another added attraction, as far as her family went, it was forbidden. Made it only all the more fun. Don't tell me I can't do something. She said, I'd sneak a few drinks upstairs in my room, and that began to be a habit. Eventually, she became dependent upon it and became a daily drinker. Then she had a week-long bender of solitary drinking, locked up in a hotel room because her family opposed of her upcoming marriage. During that week, the hotel doctor gave her sleeping pills, and she took the whole bottle. Only the actions of an alert maid saved her. Helen commented, I figured that perhaps if I went ahead with that marriage, which I was sure was right for me, that would be the answer to my drinking problem. He'll fix me. The next 5 years were filled with fear, failure, and frustration. Her doctor had suggested to her husband that he send her to AA, but little was known about it then. The doctor said it was a bunch of drunks who helped one another. Her husband thought the last thing she needed was to be around a bunch of drunks. She lost a child, her marriage ended, and she was living with her parents. She was in and out of sanitariums. Helen remarked, once I really started, I would retire to my bed and drink myself into oblivion. I fought and struggled, but to no avail. I was taken out of the house, but was put bodily into a waiting car with nothing on but a robe and a gown. I had the feeling that we alcoholics all know. What's the use? There was that awful alcoholic loneliness. I remember vaguely violent quarrels with my husband, his finding the liquor supply, and time again throwing it out. And then my waiting until I was sure he was asleep, and stealing money from him to replenish the supply. I started going to nice sanitariums, after which it turned out to be more like a country club than anything else. I learned I could refuse to sign myself in unless they gave me a glass of whiskey in one hand and a glass of formaldehyde in the other. I didn't want help. I decided I was no good, never would be any good, and the sooner I could drink myself out of this life, the better. One day, her psychiatrist left Helen's case history on her desk when she was called away from the room. Helen read it and was delighted to see that periodic drinker had been crossed out and the words chronic alcoholic were substituted. She said, I left the office and hurried around to tell the other patients that I was getting better, that I'd been promoted from a periodic drinker to a chronic alcoholic. AA didn't teach me that I was an alcoholic. Rather, it taught me that because I was an alcoholic, my life had become unmanageable. The same doctor who sent me to the psycho had asked my husband, why don't you send her to this Alcoholics Anonymous? At that time, there hadn't been any publicity such as we have now. Even the Jack Alexander article hadn't been written. And there was only a tiny group of people in Washington. So the doctor said, I don't know too much about it, but they tell me that it's a bunch of drunks who get together. And my husband interrupted, she's bad enough now without getting all mixed up with a bunch of drunks. So in those following years, whenever AA was mentioned, I'd have no part of it. In my screwed up mind, I kept thinking that I could have gone to AA way back there in the 1940 and perhaps saved my marriage and my home. I even wanted to, but I wasn't allowed to, so I won't go now. Finally, in November 1944, she went to AA, and AA took this wreck of a woman and brought her back to life. In Helen's words, in all the sanitarium and psycho wards, I'd never met a single woman who said she was an alcoholic. They were always there because of a nervous breakdown or a rest cure, any reason except for drinking. I saw that it was my life that was unmanageable, not just my drinking. With all their help, I also saw that certainly because of some of the things I had done during the years, I was bordering on insanity. And so facing the record, I tried to believe that a power greater than I would restore me to sanity. Her sponsor was a charming, delightful, lovely person, and Helen put her on a pedestal. She centered her life on this woman. Her sponsor recognized that she was depending on her and not on the AA program and began to pull away. When she broke a luncheon date with Helen, Helen got drunk to punish her. That was February of 1945, and Helen was sent back to the sanitarium where she had been so often. In reading the big book, she exclaimed, here was a book that said I could do something that all these doctors and priests and ministers, psychiatrists that I'd been going to for years couldn't do. When hospitalized, Helen realized that she had not been basing her sobriety on the book or the group or the higher power, but on an individual. She started really working the program and never drank again. She commented, I had tried honestly and sincerely to practice the 12 steps. I would have seen from my continuous moral inventory that I was getting off the beam. I would have found that there were some active resentments in my life and a terrible amount of self-pity. But more important, I would have found that once again I was sitting in the driver's seat. I was running the show. I realize that all I'm guaranteed in life is today. Each of us has but one day. What we do with it is our own business. How we use it is up to us individually. The higher power to whom I had turned and who had sustained me had once again been thrust into the background. And while my emotions were running my life, and as always, my emotions ran me to the bottle. In December of 1949, Helen became a senior staff member of the New York office. She recommended Nell Wing to work as Bill's secretary. She had previously worked for the Boston Central Service Office of AA. She proved a tremendous help to Bill Wilson, especially in promoting the traditions and the conference idea to the fellowship and in organizing the General Service Conference. She served as secretary of the first two conferences. Quite an achievement. Helen also worked closely with Bill on the booklet called The Third Legacy. If you haven't seen that, I highly recommend it. Bill said of her on page 215 in Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, "Helen B. of the office staff has a real flair of statesmanship and is the in the best sense of the word, and she understood practical politics. To her assistance throughout proved invaluable." Helen ended with, "My own innate selfishness and stubbornness are evils which, if left unguarded, can drive me to alcohol. I have come to believe that my illness is spiritual as well as physical and mental, and I know that help in the spiritual sphere, I have to turn to a higher power." In March 1955, she resigned to be married and moved to Texas. Can you hold off on that one? Just a second. Okay, this next lady is one of which I have a lot of identification. Oddly enough, her name is Nancy. So let's listen to Nancy.
"And we, in those days, we didn't all have cars and all that sort of thing. And we'd go in buses and we'd go in trolley cars and we'd go anywhere. Anywhere we'd find somebody drinking and didn't want to be drinking, we would be there. And that gave me something inside of myself that I had, that I didn't know I had. That I had something I could give away. And that strengthened my equilibrium, or my ego, or whatever. But oh, I felt so good when I would do that."
Thank you, Nancy. This is Nancy Flynn, the Independent Blonde, New York City, page 532 in the second edition. Nancy came to AA in June 1945 when she was 39 years old. She did not write her own story, which was written by some writers in AA, and she claims that she didn't even know it was in the big book. She left home at 14. Her mother had died when she was 3. Her father remarried when she was 14, and her stepmother kicked her out. Nancy says, "When you're thrown out, you don't feel like you're anything. You know something's got to be wrong, or they wouldn't have thrown you out. And they tell me that psychologically I felt abandoned by my mother. All my life I blamed everything that ever happened to me on someone else, and I usually could find someone. I thought if I left my husband, things would be different." Seems to be a common thread among us. "I never thought about changing myself. I always thought about changing people or changing places." She had made a few geographic cures, but they didn't work. She kept quitting jobs, not having the courage to wait to be fired. Nancy wrote, "I had heard about AA years before I came in, but I thought it was kind of an organization that helped you out financially. And I was too independent for that. But on June 1st, 1945, I had lost all that kind of independence." Her contact with AA was at the clubhouse on 334 and a half West 24th Street in New York. Nancy said, "I got someone on the telephone and I told her that I was in trouble and asked, what should I do? The girl asked me if I could walk and I said to myself, my God, how understanding. Somebody knows that you couldn't walk, and why? And the girl said, well, the only reason I ask you is if you can't, we'll send somebody over to pick you up. And I reared up in all my arrogance, and I said, you will never come to me, but I'll come to you. And it took me until 4 o'clock that day to get there. She expected to be met by a bunch of bums, but so did not get dressed up because she didn't want to look better than anybody else. When she arrived, Park Avenue types were there, and she said, I was so welcome. It was the first time I felt welcome. I don't know who spoke first, last, or what, but somebody got up and said that he had been in Bellevue 35 times, and I thought, oh my God, I'll look like St. Cecilia here. One day a call came in to the clubhouse for someone to go out and do a 12-step job. They looked at me and said, how long are you in? And I said, a week or so. And they said, well, you can't go. You have to be sober for 3 months. Then I realized that here I was. I'd spent all my life afraid that people were trying to get something out of me, and I had nothing to give. I had to wait until these people gave it to me so that I could go out and give it away. She was impressed on coming to AA to meet a countess, Felicia Gazitsky, from Stars Don't Fall. See how our lives got all intertwined. At that time, Nancy had a little beauty shop and could often give permanence to members of AA, those who could afford to pay her and those who could not. She and another young woman, perhaps Marty Mann, were often asked to go to hospitals and drying out places frequented by the wealthy because they were younger and presentable. They brought little hats with flowers on them and wore little black dresses with pearls. On these occasions, they looked so nice. I was so eager to give what I had. She said, I went right from the first step to the last step. You see, I had never cared for anybody, not even myself. And when you care for somebody, you begin to heal yourself. You don't even know it. She often went to Dr. Silkworth for advice. If we were in trouble, we'd go to Dr. Silkworth. If we were in a situation we didn't know what to do or how to get out of it, we were afraid we might get drunk, we could go over and talk it over with him. He's a very simple, wonderful man. He said to me one day, the day that you can just sit down and be honest with yourself in this situation, you will know what to do. That was the kind of man he was. Nancy went to the clubhouse every day from 11 o'clock in the morning when they opened until they closed at night. It was the only place she felt safe. Nancy ended her story with, the more I worry about me loving you, the less I'll worry about you loving me, and the happier I'll be. I have learned that the more I give, the more I will have, and the more I learn to give, the more I will learn to live. For the first 5 years, she did nothing but go to AA. She didn't know what else to do. For 15 years, she attended a women's meeting that Marty Mann started in her home on 58th Street in Midtown Manhattan. Marty wanted to hire her as a speaker for the National Council on Alcoholism, but she declined. Nancy is a good example of what people can accomplish after they get sober. She went to high school in her 50s and went to college when she was 70. She studied behavioral science. And then she went to college for 9.5 years and graduated cum laude. When she arrived at AA, she didn't believe in God and didn't want to hear anything about it. That was me. But she began searching. Later, she became a Quaker and taught English to migrant workers. She lived in Pennsylvania and spoke at the 2000 AA International Convention in Minneapolis. How many of you were there? Good. That was great. She passed away on April 16th, 2005, claiming 57 years of sobriety, although she drank twice during those 57 years. Go figure. I thought about not putting her story, including her story, because of that. And Gail Lassie told me she's part of our history. Keep her in there. Our next one was a real live wire. Unfortunately, I don't have a photo of Annie, but you can use your imagination. I love Annie. Annie the cop fighter, Annie Kohlhaas, New York City, page 514 of the second edition. I wish we'd kept her. In April of 1947, Annie arrived in AA at 67 years old. She was a scrub lady for 25 cents an hour, poor and uneducated. She started to drink in 1913 at age 31. When women sat in the back room. Because of her drinking, her husband took her two small boys and left, and she said, "Didn't worry me a bit. I love the liquor, and I love the crowd that I hung out with. I would have done anything to get the money for a drink." She got in a fight with a cop, tore the buttons off his uniform, and when the cop said he was taking her in, she says, "Well, do as you damn please." I was a tough piece of furniture in those days. If the Almighty God had come down, I'd done the same thing to him. She was charged with molesting a policeman's uniform and got 5 days in the house of detention. She said, "The only thing I was worrying about is how that gang was making out with me, without me. But they made out all right." I was in court again for drunken disorderly. 30 days, says the judge, and I reared right up and spit clean in the judge's eyes, a distance of 5 feet. That judge shouted, "Another 30 days for spitting in the eye of the court." "Nuts to you," says I, but I had to serve the whole 60 days. After being away from her family for 15 years, she was on her way to a speakeasy and met her husband, who asked her if she'd like to drink. "Ho, ho, ho, woo. Would I? Sure I would." So they had a few drinks at the speakeasy, and she went home with him. She couldn't stand the decent life and just wanted to be a drunk and kept on drinking. She gave her husband credit for raising their two sons. She said the youngest boy was going to be a policeman. "Brother! Oh! Well, it was all right. I had to take it and accept it. But every time I thought of that uniform, it just killed me." She was obnoxious, stole change from the other customers, black and blue from being kicked and knocked around. She drank with the gals and the guys on the Bowery, and her whole clothes and her body were just filled with lice. Annie offered her old drinking buddy Irene a drink, but Irene told her she couldn't take that first drink. Annie told her, "Well, saints above, what happened to you?" "Well, I said, nuts to you, I'm having mine." But Irene said she was going to get her. Annie replied, "Over my dead body." On May 12, 1946, she called Irene to take her where she went on Sunday nights. So down to the old 24th Street Clubhouse they went to a beginner's meeting where she met Nancy Flynn, whose story in the big book is The Independent Blonde. Another connection. The clubhouse disbanded in 1941. Annie sobered up that night after 32 years of drinking. She said she never shook hands or said hello to anyone. She just ran in and ran out of meetings. She married another drunk, and after 8 months got into an argument with him and drank for 2 days. She said, "Those nosy AAs caught up with me somehow, and this damn organization knows my whole business. Nobody ever stepped over my territory before in my life." She said, "I don't know what AA does to you, but those you can never drink the same again. She was sent to High Watch Farm for 2 days and returned a new woman. Nancy encouraged Annie to take her fifth step with a priest. She told the priest, "Father, I'll tell you everything, but don't ask me how many times." And she cursed a lot when she spoke, but then she would look at the priest in the audience. She'd say, "Excuse me, Father, I'm trying to be careful." Nancy was a hairdresser, and when Annie came to the beauty shop, she would charge her a dollar because she never wanted her to think that she gave her anything, because Nancy was very proud. By the way, I had to learn to use that machine when I went to beauty school in 1957. It was sort of like an electric chair. Annie, thank God we don't use them anymore. Annie later went to another beauty shop, and when they charged her $6, she says, "Hell, I get done for a buck up on Park Avenue." Annie concluded her story with gratitude for what AA had done for her. Her boys were back in her life. She exclaimed, "I live on that 24-hour plan. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I don't mind the name of an alcoholic because I was called a son of a this and a son of a that, and an alcoholic is a good enough name for me. To newcomers, I say go to meetings, and God take care of each and every one of you." Annie Kohlhaas died when she was about 74. This courageous lady has made an impact on the lives of countless alcoholics. Win Quorum Laws, Freedom from Bondage, Ventura, California, page 553 in the second edition, 544 in the third and fourth. And they took out one of the paragraphs, and we'll get to it. And I wish they put that back in, just to make the pages come out even. When she joined, this AA believes her serious drinking was a result of even deeper defects. She tells here how she was set free. Wynn joined AA in California July 25th, 1947, at age 33. She was described by the novelist Carolyn C., one of her several stepchildren, as tall, with a face that was astonishing in its beauty. She had the translucent skin that had a tiny dusting of freckles and Audrey Hepburn cheekbones, bright red hair, turquoise eyes, and she was a knockout. She believed that her alcoholism was a symptom of a deeper trouble, that her mental and emotional difficulties began many years before she began to drink. But AA taught her that she was the result of the way she reacted to what happened to her as a child. She learned that she could change this reaction pattern and match calamity with serenity. Bill Wilson's mother, Emily, divorced his father, Gilman, and he and his sister, Dorothy, were raised by their maternal grandparents. Wynn was born in Florida, and her parents separated when she was a child. She was sent to live in poverty with her grandparents in the Midwest. This common childhood experience may have been one of the reasons for the reported close friendship that she had with Bill Wilson. She reports feeling restlessness, anxiety, fear, and insecurity. The only kind of security, and I knew anything about at that time, was material security. And I decided that all these feelings would vanish immediately if only I had a lot of money, of course. She married and divorced 4 times before finding AA. She said, "I didn't have the capacity to love. I didn't have the courage to love. I was not even sure I had the capacity." The first time she married for financial security, her second husband was Stan Kenton, a prominent band leader. She sang with his band. Her third husband was an army captain that she married during World War II. Her fourth husband was a widower with several children. One AA friend quipped when hearing Wynn's story that she had always been a cinch for the program because she had always had an interest in mankind. She was just taking them one man at a time. Wynn stated that there had been no emotional maturity at all. And I realized that now this phase of my development had been arrested with my obsession with self. And I was so immersed in self-pity and resentment. My remorse and shame and humiliation when I was sober were almost unbearable. As soon as my day was finished, I could drink myself into oblivion again. I knew it didn't make any difference where I started. The inevitable would be Skid Row. I always felt like I had one foot stepping over, just waiting to step down to Skid Row. Wynn wrote, I attended my first AA meeting on July 25th, 1947. And this is so important. I take no sedation or narcotics, for this program to me is one of complete sobriety. And I no longer need to escape reality. There is just one good drunk in every alcoholic's life, and that's the one that brings us into AA. I believe, too, that it's equally impossible to practice these principles to the best of our ability a day at a time and still drink. But I don't think the two things are compatible. A willingness to believe is enough for a beginning. When she wrote her story, she'd been in AA for 8 years, and her life had changed dramatically. She had not had a drink since her first meeting, had not only found a way to live without having a drink, but a way to live without wanting a drink. Sometime after 1955, her story appeared in the Big Book, and she married her fifth husband, George Laws, another AA member. George and Wynn were married for several years, and his daughter, Carolyn, lived with them for a while. Carolyn said George and Wynn were a popular team speaking at meetings. My dad was Wynn's opening act. He couldn't help but be funny. And then he would refer to Wynn, whose tail was hair-raising. After they were divorced, according to Carolyn, Wynn dated a wealthy insurance executive whom she had hoped to marry. Carolyn writes, Wynn's mother had deserted her in order to go out and live a selfish life. An unloving grandmother reared her in strict poverty. She contracted typhoid fever and hovered between life and death for about 90 days. All her hair, and though she would not admit it, her teeth fell out. She recovered at about 16, and her beautiful red hair began to grow back in. And she wore dentures stuck in so firmly that nobody ever saw her without them. Don't you love the dentures? According to Carolyn, Wynn began carving out a career seeking men and money and started to drink to bridge the gap between the grim reality that she was born into and the American dream that she had yearned for. Wynn said in her story that she didn't know how to love. Fear of rejection and pain and were not to be risked. When she found alcohol, it seemed to solve her problems for a time. But jails and hospitals followed. When she wound up in a hospital for detoxification, she began to take stock and realize that she had lived with no sense of social obligation or responsibility to her fellow men. She was full of resentments and fears. An article by Norman Vincent Peale helped her with a 25-year resentment against her mother. He said, in effect, hold on a second. If you have a resentment you want to be rid of, if you will pray for the person or thing that you resent, you will be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Do it every day for 2 weeks, and you will find that you have come to mean it and to want it for them. And you will realize where you used to feel bitterness, resentment, and hatred, you now feel compassionate, understanding, and love. I call this the 2 week diet prayer. And if I miss a day, I have to start over. And this prayer saved my first husband's life. Wynn gives us precious gems such as these. I will have peace of mind in exact proportion to the peace of mind I bring into the lives of others. As another great man says, the only real freedom a human being can ever have is doing what you ought to do because you want to do it. That great man may have been Bill Wilson. And I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I need, I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it's just what I wanted all the time. Wynn and Jack P. of Los Angeles started more than 80 meetings in hospitals, jails, and prisons in Southern California from about 1947 to 1950. Jack reports, and I knew Jack. Jack reports that during this period, they were widely criticized by other members of the fellowship who thought that this was something that AA should not do. Carolyn wrote, AA can said to have worked for my father and for Wynn. Although they would divorce, neither of them would ever drink again. Let's listen to a recording of Wynn's talk from the 1955 International Convention in St. Louis, Missouri.
It didn't make any difference that I didn't
hear. Hallelujah.
You see, I took something away with me. Something that was enough to make me get through the balance of that night without having to take a drink. Something that was enough to make me get through the entire next day without having to take a drink of anything. And this was something that I had sensed. Something that I had felt was present in the room. I had no name for it. And I've heard as many names as I suppose could be found in any county of West. I don't think it matters what we call this thing that's present at an alcoholic time. I just know that I sensed you had something that I like.
Thank you. Really touches me, and I want to thank Tim and Mike for these recordings. It brings them to life. Wynn was a girl who lost nearly all, but changed, improved, and transformed thousands of lives. She apparently died in poverty of cancer on December 17th, 1974, at age 60. So I was 2 years sober when she died. In gratitude to our women pioneers, and especially women like Wynn Laws who paved the way for us, I'd like to acknowledge all of those who have carried messages into institutions and all of those who have received the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in an institution. God bless you for that. And thank you. Thank you for carrying the message of hope. And I'm sure many of us can identify with this next story. And unfortunately, I don't have a photo of her. If anybody comes up with a photo of Annie Kohlhaus, I would love to have it. And this would be Muriel H. from New York. If you have a picture of Muriel or anything more that you know about her, please let me know and I will include her. This is the housewife who drank at home, Muriel H. from New York, New York. page 375 in the second edition, 335 in the third edition. She hid her bottles. Oh, Drew is on this. I know he's going to come up with this for me. She hid her bottles and clothes hampers in dresser drawers. She realized that she was what she was becoming in AA and discovered that she had lost nothing and had found everything. This story is of an alcoholic woman who stayed at home to care for her family. Her bar was her kitchen, her living room, her bedroom, the back bathroom, and two hampers. She had never been a very heavy social drinker, but during a period of particular stress and strain, she resorted to alcohol in her home, alone as a means of temporary release and of getting a little extra sleep. She didn't think a little wine would hurt her, but soon she was a chronic wine drinker, and she needed it, and I was a winette. She said, I don't believe when I started that I even had in mind the thought that I was drinking. I had to sleep. I had to clear my mind and to free it from the worry, and I had to relax. I just couldn't live without it. I just wanted to live to a certain age, carry through with what I felt was my job with the children, and after that, no matter. Half a mother was better than no mother at all. She became secretive about how much she drank. She pretended to be doing a lot of entertaining when she bought more wine, not wanting the clerk to know it was for her. She wrote, I wandered from room to room, thinking, drinking, drinking, thinking, and thinking, and on and on. And the mops would get out, the vacuum would get out, everything would get out, but nothing would get done. Toward 5 o'clock, helter-skelter, I'd get everything put away, try to get supper on the table, and after supper, I'd finish the job and knock myself out. If I could only stop thinking, I wouldn't drink. If only I could stop drinking, maybe I wouldn't think. But they were all mixed up together, and I was all mixed up inside. I didn't care what I looked like. I didn't care what I did. To me, taking a bath was just a place with a bottle where I could find a little privacy. When the doctor prescribed a little brandy for her son to help him through the night when he coughed, she switched from wine to brandy, of course, for 3 weeks. Soon she was in DTs and screaming on the telephone for her mother and her husband to come and help her. Muriel said, I knew that alcohol and I had to part. I couldn't live with it anymore, and yet how was I going to live without it? The people who would have come to help me were just the people I would have nothing to do with. Thinking it would help if she got out of the house, she became active in civic affairs. As long as she worked, she didn't drink, but had to get back to that first drink somehow. While she was out of the house, her behavior was fine. But her husband and children saw the other side of her. She had turned into that Jekyll and Hyde personality. She said, I became one of the most active women in the community, what with PTA and other community organizations and drives. I'd go to an organization. It wasn't long before I was on the committee. Then I was chairman of the committee. And if I was in a group, I'd soon be the treasurer or the secretary of the group. But I wasn't happy. My husband and the children saw the other side of me. When the children were in school from 9 to 3, she started a little business and was fairly successful, but it was just a substitute for drink, and she needed that drink. When all of life is a substitute for a drink, there's no happiness, no peace. She tried switching to beer, which she had hated. Now she grew to love it and would drink it warm or cold. Her husband, whom she had turned against and treated badly, stayed with her and tried to help her. Finally, a doctor recommended AA. At one time, the admission that she was an alcoholic meant shame, defeat, and failure to her. Now she was able to interpret that defeat and that failure and that shame as seeds of victory. It was only through feeling defeat and feeling failure, the inability to cope with her life and with alcohol, that she was able to surrender and accept the fact that she had the disease of alcoholism and that she had to learn to live without alcohol. In AA, she found that for the first time, she could face her problems honestly and squarely. She took everything that AA had to give her. She surrendered. To her, surrender brought with it the ability to run her home, to face her responsibilities, to take life as it comes day by day. She had surrendered once to the bottle and couldn't do those things. Muriel concluded, since I gave my will over to AA, whatever AA has wanted of me, I have tried to do to the best of my ability. When I'm asked to go on a call, I go. I'm not going. It's AA leading me there. AA gives us alcoholic direction in a way of life without the need for alcohol. That life is, for me, one day at a time. Letting the problems of the future rest with the future. When the time comes to solve them, God will give me the strength for that day. She was brought to believe in God, brought up to believe in God, but not until she found AA did she know faith in the reality of God. A God, the reality of his power that is now with her in everything she does. This lady tells it like it is and how she overcame fear. I don't have a photo of her either, so anybody has a picture of Seal Mansfield, please let me know. She was from New York City. Fear of Fear, page 330 in the second edition, page 321 in the third edition. This lady was cautious. She decided she wouldn't let herself go on her drinking, and she would never, never take that morning drink. Seal's date of sobriety was, according to one source, July 1949. Her husband, George, joined shortly before she did. She exclaimed, "I thought it was wonderful, simply marvelous, for him, but not for me." She thought she was not an alcoholic, that her problem was that she had been married to a drunk. But finally admitted to a woman that she met when she accompanied George to the Greenwich Village group that she, too, had a problem. Seal added, "For the first time in my life, I said to another human being, I'm having trouble with my drinking, too. I knew it was just as much, I was just as much a drunk as George, if not worse, and I nudged George the next morning, and I said, I'm in." He said, "Oh, I knew you would make it." She was one who never went to a hospital, never lost a job, had never been to jail. Nevertheless, she was a severe alcoholic. She believes that she should have lost her husband, but the fact that he was an alcoholic, too, kept them together. She said, "My husband liked to have a good time. I was very young, and I wanted to have a good time, too. The only way I knew to do it was to drink right along with him. I always wanted to drink too much, so I was watchful, always watchful, counting my drinks. If I were going to a party and I knew there was going to be only going to have one or two drinks, I wouldn't have any. I knew that if I did take one or two, I might want to take five or six or seven or eight. I really never did take a morning drink. I was still woozy from the night before. I lost my self-respect. I could feel fear coming into my life. I couldn't face people. I'd brazen things out. I'd lied like a trooper to get out of many scrapes. I hid quite a bit of the time, wouldn't answer the phone, and stayed by myself as much as I could. I never knew it was the first drink that did it. I thought I was losing my mind when I realized that I couldn't stop drinking. And that frightened me terribly. She wrote an update of her story entitled "So Changed a Life" for the September 1968 AA Grapevine. In it, she tells how dramatically their lives changed. When she came to AA, Seal was spiritually, mentally, and physically beaten. Her children were ashamed of her. Her family did not want any part of her. This all sounds so familiar. She revealed something always would come up that would throw me. It'd be a little thing like the rugs being crooked, or silly little things that I think was wrong, and then I'd go off drinking and sneaking my drinks. I hid my bottles, had them hidden all over the apartment. I didn't think my children knew about it, but I found out they did. It's surprising how we think we fool everybody about our drinking. I would lie on the bathroom floor, deathly sick, praying I would die, and praying to God as I'd always prayed to him when I was drinking. You all know this one. Dear God, get me out of this one, and I'll never do it again. And then I'd say, God, please don't pay any attention to me. You know I'll do it all again tomorrow, the very same thing. I'd egg George on to drink and get started again. And then I'd fight with him because he has started. She reported that now their family trusted them again, and physically they were in better shape than they were when they came in. Their friends were all in the fellowship. She continued with, "We have faith in each other, trust in each other, and understanding. AA has given us that. I can't afford resentments against anyone because they are a buildup of another drunk. I must live and let live. I try to live today that so tomorrow I won't be ashamed when I wake up in the morning." What a gift. George had found it tough going financially for a while, so the women in AA suggested that she get a job. She reflected, "I could never be sure that I'd have a clear head and hands that were willing to do some work. I felt depleted and whipped. I had time. I certainly had the capability, but I never did a thing." She went to work for a New York advertising agency as a receptionist, but soon gained the confidence to look for a better job with more responsibility and a better salary. But she complained about the office politics and how the other women snickered when she told them she did not tell lies. Office politics were strange for her. She said that she had always been honest, even when drinking, but this office hanky-panky was new. She loved her work, but admitted that 19 years earlier, she would not have the serenity to take the office politics. George finally got started in his profession. After 18 years, they were both still active in AA and doing a lot of 12-step work. She expressed enormous gratitude to the fellowship for all it had given them, and she said that they were not reformed drunks. They were informed alcoholics. Seal said, "I never thought I could be useful to anyone except my husband and my children, perhaps a few friends. But AA has shown me that I can help other alcoholics. I love my AA freedom. It is the one fellowship It is the one fellowship that has given us our lives, our freedom, and our happiness." And she concludes that, "I know to whom I owe my gratitude, my fellow members of AA. I am trying now each day to make up for those selfish, thoughtless, foolish things I did in my drinking days. I hope that I never forget to be grateful. An AA Grapevine article originally published in September 1968 appeared in the November 1979 issue celebrating her 30th sobriety birthday. It also was reprinted in the 1999 AA Grapevine under the category Big Book Authors. She had been identified by one source as Seal Mansfield, but an update was signed CF. Perhaps that was a typo in the AA Grapevine, or perhaps she's been using her maiden name for professional reasons, or perhaps she remarried after being divorced or widowed. Who knows? I changed my last name 3 times and written in my cover of my big book, but I haven't had to change my sobriety date, so it's okay. The stories from the first 2 editions of the Big Book can be found in the conference-approved book, Experience, Strength, and Hope. I hope you've enjoyed learning about all of these 12 incredible women of Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I have. Thank you for allowing me to share this bit of history with you today.